Part 2. Exiles. Chapter 1. The mountains lay far behind. Lost long since, behind the hills and rivers and plains of the southwest. The clouds and weathers of the journey. The southwestern post was climbing into the hills of the Molson province. Uncultivated, dull gold, under a blue-grey August sky. 5 more miles to Fontanesfray, said the handsome, swag-bellied driver. The Grand Duchess comes to Fontanesfray every August to take the waters. How far is it from the city? Asked the young provincial gentleman on the box. 16 miles, 8, the brakes on. We won't see West Gate much before nightfall. The horses, heavy, gleaming greys, pulled effortlessly. A snow mile went by. Itali pulled his hat over his eyes against the warm morning sun and dozed. The horses pulled. The high coach creaked and swayed. Village of Colpera, the coachman pointed out. Colpera was a humble cluster of huts off the road on a high slope. Looks like sheep country, Itali said. I wouldn't know, the coachman replied with disdain. I am from the city. I know nothing and care nothing about sheep, said his manner. And Itali rebuked, stretched out his legs, and gazed at the great lonely hills, where, sure enough, far away, and like a cloud shadow on the tawny slope, he made out a flock of sheep. Fontanesfray was a cool, rich town high up in the hills. The inside passengers took lunch in the park restaurant. Itali, who had refused to borrow money from his uncle, or to take more than 20 kruna from the estate cash box, and that as a loan, bought a roll at a bakery and ate it by himself in the park in the shade of the elms, watching the fancy rigs go by on Gulhelm Street. He finished his roll and was hungry. Through summery, leaf-dappled light, he saw a low foreign chaise coming, drawn by matched bays. In the chaise was a parasol, and in the warm, white shadow of the parasol, a face was turned towards him. A long, bored face, with heavy lips and tired eyes. So familiar that Itali expected her to speak to him. Which cousin was she? The chaise passed, and parasol became a white blot down the dapple street. Itali brushed crumbs off his waistcoat. Well, so that's the Grand Duchess, he said to himself, and felt unspeakably mournful and insignificant. The coach set off with new horses and several new passengers. One of these Itali had seen on Gulhelm Street, bowing to the Grand Duchess's chaise, a young man elegantly dressed, with a pale, handsome, heavy face. He sat up outside with Itali and made conversation, chattering along so amiably that Itali soon forgot to act sophisticated and began to enjoy himself. A little cautious, for he was not used to talking with strangers, he listened more than he spoke. This pleased his companion, who was not much in demand as a talker among his own associates. In their mutual appreciation, they introduced themselves. Sode Paludeska. As soon as the names were spoken, each must perform a little silent guesswork and assessment. Itali, wondering which rank of the nobility his new friend might belong to. Paludeska, deciding that although the young provincial was a commoner and had a hat which looked as though he'd gone fishing with it, he was quite safely a gentleman. And it was very pleasant to talk to someone who knew so little about everything and never set him straight. He talked on, and Itali listened, and each was grateful to the other. The coach came at 5 o'clock to the summit of the hills, and Itali saw for the first time the broad sweep of the river valley to the distant eastern range, the shining curve of the Molson through it, and hazy and glimmering in the low warm light, the city on the river's bend. They were some miles from its outskirts. The pale hills behind them were silent, a pale sky arched overhead. The city slept in its wide valley in the afternoon sunlight, indistinct, beautiful, unutterably calm. Paludiska smiled with proprietary pleasure, glancing at Itali's intent, gazing face. "Is that the Ruka?" He pointed to a building that bulked large in bluish shadow over the vague surrounding streets in the southwest quarter of the city. "Right, there's the Sinalia at the edge of that green bit. That must be the park, the Elena Prada." The Sinalia Palace was the residence of the reigning Grand Ducal family. The kings of Orsinia had lived in the Ruk Palace. "That must be the cathedral," Itali said, and his voice caught, for the spires, rising above the golden mass and shadow of the city, were its centre both in place and in the passage of centuries. "Right," said Paludiska, "and south of it there, that's River Quarter. Nobody lives there. North of it, the Old Quarter. That's where everybody lives. Is that my house? Can't be sure. There's the Opera House. See the dome by the river?" But the coach, descending, entered a pass between high hills, and the view was lost. It reappeared at intervals, each time nearer and more complex as the road wound down. Their last sight of the city as a whole was when the valley was vague. The eastern hills had dimmed away. The lights were beginning to glimmer through the grey haze. They changed horses at Kolonomana, supped there, and in the warm dusk set off again, rolling easily on a smooth road, the glow of the city under its haze brightening always in the sky before them. Exalted by the darkness and warmth, the wind and movement of the ride, the great presence of the city awaiting them, the two young men talked from their souls. "The important thing," Itali said, "is a force inside you that belongs to you alone. It is yourself, actually, all that makes you a self, a man. Once you've found it, that force or will or need, whatever it is, all you have to do is obey it. Stay on the road it takes you." "But if you can't find the road?" "You can if you want to." "How many people really want to? To find their destiny? To be themselves? Surely everyone does." "Takes work," said Paludiska. "Well, it does. And it's true, most people don't even seem to try. They do what comes next, or what's expected of them, and get lost in a meaningless tangle of desires, frivolities, contingencies," said Itali, with an abolishing wave of his hand. "Why don't they simply do what's necessary?" "Easier not to. But how stupid it is. Even if you sit in a chair for 10 years, still the years go by. So why not get up and walk? Make it a journey. I used to envy adults when I was a boy. I thought they were all going somewhere. But now I see most of them not really going anywhere. Never getting home. Lost in eating and sleeping and talking and visiting and meaningless work. Not the poor, of course. I mean, the people free to do as they please. They do nothing. They lose their souls out of sheer carelessness. Civilizations wasted on humanity," said Paludiska. "If I had to hand out, I'd give it to the bees. Industrious little bastards. I don't know if it's wasted on us, but most of us seem to waste it. I used to think I'd like to add my bit, but I don't know. I suppose I really haven't anything to add. You do, Itali said. And Paludiskar replied with equal simplicity, I know, but it's getting away from me. I'm not religious, you know, and all that, but I'm going to be 25 in November. I'd like to, you know, to think that I was going to do something worth doing before the end. That's it. That's it, Itali said. Come and stay the night. I want to talk more about this, Paludiskar said earnestly, and Itali agreed. The coach was among the suburbs of Krasnoi, and in 10 minutes more, it came to a halt inside the west gate. Stiff, bemused, disjointed, its passengers descended into the coachyard of Tipontioi Street, under the dark, looming inn buildings. Glare and shadow, neighing of horses, and clatter of iron-shod hoofs on stone, clatter of voices, moths swarming at smoking lamps, smells of leather, horse dung, sweat, hot stone, the streets of stone. In the cab, both regretted the invitation, which had seemed so natural on the coach. They said no more about destiny and civilization. Each looked out of his window. The cab stopped before a handsome house on a wide, quiet street. As Paludiskar took him up the steps, Itali heard a great bell striking the hour across the dark roofs and streets, a deep, quiet voice in the restless air of the city night. He was handed over to a servant, taken up imposing stairs and down a long passage to a room with a curtain bed, marble fireplace, Turkish carpet, red-draped windows, and a very large painting of a racehorse with a fat, round body and tiny head and feet. As the one servant departed, a second one arrived, carrying his valise. "Thank you," Itali said, relieved to see the familiar object, an anchor in a sea of strangeness. His effort to get the valise away from the man was foiled with skill, courtesy, and ease. After that defeat, there was no hope of making the man go away. He was French and middle-aged. As he unpacked Itali's valise, he intimated that his name was Robert, that he was Monsieur le Baron's man, that Itali must change into his other coat, that a clean shirt was also desirable, that a gentleman did not put on his own shirt, that Robert was perfectly aware that Itali was young, poor, provincial, and possessed no articles of toilet besides a hairbrush, but did not hold it against him. Some of this in words, some by other means. If Monsieur will permit, he said, circling behind Itali at the looking-glass, and in 5 hypnotic motions transformed Itali's cravat into a model of austere symmetry. It is the best knot, but not every man can wear it so. It requires the long face, he said, admiring his handiwork so honestly that Itali warmed to him at last, and let him help him into his coat without a struggle. Then he had to go downstairs alone. The long, bright drawing-room was a confusion of people, light-coated men, light-gowned women. He did not see Paludiskar anywhere. A tall, fair woman glanced at him, frowning. He dared not move farther forward. He dared not go back. There he stood, like a rock. Near him, a group broke out laughing at the end of a story, and he smiled too, until he found he was smiling. Another tall, fair woman in violet was approaching him. Or was it the same one? She was coming straight at him. He looked away. He began to edge backwards towards the hall. Mr. Sode, he bowed. I am Luisa Paludeska. He bowed. She looked at him coolly, made up her mind, and took him to present him to her mother. The young baroness was robust and handsome, like her brother. The old baroness, sitting near a gold-encrusted Erard piano with two other ladies, looked pinched, sick, and sour. She said, "How do you do?" to Itali, and had no more to say to him. Baroness Luisa took him on to a side room, where, to his relief, he found Paludeska devouring cold chicken and champagne, and was invited to do the same. While he ate, he managed to shake off the paralysis of total self-consciousness and make some observation of other people. He found that nobody was wearing trousers at all like his, and that conversation with these people was very difficult, as they all spoke quickly and bounced on from one subject to the next like rabbits. "Will you be long in Krasnoy, Mr. Sode?" asked a man to whom he'd just been introduced, and whose name he had instantly mislaid. And before he decided how to answer, the other bounced on. "Absolutely dead just now. Few remaining fragments of civilization are gathered in this room, and the opera's not opening until November." "I hope to see the opera," said Itali, and was able to take a deep breath, having produced a comprehensible, if not dazzling, sentence. "Your musical?" asked the other man. "Was his name Hasheska? Hareska? It's not precisely Paris, as you can imagine. An old Montini lost his high A last season, but it does very well." "Paolina," Itali brought out, the name of a local diva whom he had heard praised at Solari. "Aha," said Haleska. "That was it. Haleska. But Baron? Count? Prince? Have you heard Paolina? Is it she that brings you here?" Itali stared at him. What was he to say? "No, I am here to subvert the government." He said flatly, "No." Haleska smiled. He was pale like Paludeska, but his figure was slight, and his face fine-drawn. "I'm sorry, I'm always boring people with music," he said. And though Itali appreciated that good-natured courtesy, he was unable to respond to it. "Luisa," said Haleska, a little later in the other room, "who is your brother's new friend?" "I have no idea, George." "Literary," Haleska proposed. Luisa Paludeska shrugged. "Epic poems. I know. He's planning to found a clandestine journal full of long quotations from Schiller." "No idea at all. He was simply found on the coach, like someone else's hat. He might be a spy for Gents. He might steal the silver. I had no idea Enrique was so rash, but then no spy could possibly tie his cravat that well, at least not a spy for Austria. It must be Schiller, after all." "Introduce him to Amadei, then. Is he here? How is he?" "Wretched, of course. I don't know why he doesn't leave that woman. There's your friend. Take him over to Amadei, Mr. Sode." Itali, startled, looked round. His eyes met Luisa Paludeska's. And for an instant, she too looked startled, taken off guard. Then her face closed and looked bored, even rancorous. "Count Haleska has been speculating that your propensities are literary," she said, drawling. And Haleska broke in, "I leave speculation to bankers, Baronina." I never go further than entertaining fancies. I have a bad habit of deciding what people ought to do without consulting them. I'd rather decided you ought to publish. Defend yourself, Mr. Soddy. Is it an accusation? Itari asked naively. Haleska laughed. We'll have to consult Stenska. Is literature a crime, a fault, or merely a misfortune? Estenska? Amadei Estenska. You stand self-accused, Mr. Soddy, Haleska said. He's here tonight. May I introduce you? He has no... That is, there's no... I don't... Come along, the Count said. And Itali meekly came, obeying Haleska's flawless self-assurance. But halfway across the room, his protest became audible again. Count, he said earnestly, I can't intrude on Mr. Estenska. You set him higher than the rest of us, Helenska said, with his ironic smile. Quite right. Come on. He led on. He'll be in here, no doubt. The mausoleum, that library, I mean. Refurbished catacomb. There he is. And bringing Itali to a wiry, red-haired, white-faced man, who stood reading in a corner of the bookcases, he introduced them. A fellow exile, Amadei, he said. Estenska had gained his fame with the publication of The Torrents of Caresha when he was 19. His odes and a novel had confirmed his reputation. At the age of 24, he was the best-known writer in his country, passionately reviled and praised, a storm-bringer, one of those after whose passing things are not the same. Very glad, he said in a dry voice. There was a pause. You're from my part of the country. From Montana. I see. What are you reading, Amadei?
Herder.
Weist mir. Literature is a vast slough of German poets. Estenska shrugged. Itali observed the shrug with awe, and burned to go reread Herder as soon as possible. But as Haleska continued to make conversation with Estenska, to cut it short, the talk did not grow more interesting. Of course, there was no reason why a genius should converse with a flippant worldling like Count Haleska. The genius's manners were disagreeable, but that was because he was so far above his company. All these people did was gossip. Itali had listened now to a dozen conversations of gossip. As a matter of fact, Estenska was now embarked on some gossip, and apparently enjoying it. A year in Paris couldn't civilize that ass, he was ending his tale, with an artificial, unpleasant tenor laugh. Nothing could. And Haleska laughed and said, civilization is wasted on humanity. And Itali struggled desperately to swallow a yawn. He looked up from the struggle to find Estenska's cold gaze on him. Did you know about Adanska's new literary magazine, Amadei, to which only noblemen may contribute? Estenska laughed his high, loud, ha-ha-ha. What next? The name. That's the beauty of it. He discussed it with me at length. Pegasus, Aurora, all nine muses couldn't use them. Greek, low connotations. Tried French, Revue du Haut Monde. Ha-ha, I say. That'll put the Revue des Deux Mondes in its place. No, no, can't have that. Low connotations again. Then the divine afflatus swept into him before my very eyes, and he said, I shall call it the Journal of Nobility and Genius. My God, what a fool the man is. He'll do it, you know. You must contribute. I'll do it in order to lose him his census permit. It's not that bad, surely, Haleska said, with a very slight change of tone. Estenska shrugged and was silent. You still haven't got the printing permit for the new book, Haleska said, and again Estenska shrugged. He stuck Herder back on the bookshelf, looked at his fingernails, turned away, then swung back and burst out shrilly. I've been trying to get it for 6 weeks now. They want changes. One of the poems can't be published at all. Why? Why not? It's about listening to music. What in the name of God is political about that? Because it's music, does it have to be the Marseillaise? Oh, no. Mr. Estenska, you don't understand. I don't understand my work, my own work, but they do. It's not the subject of the poem that is undesirable, but the meter. The meter! The meter! By the bowels of Christ! What is radical about iambic tetrameter? Do you know? Can you imagine what he said? It's a national meter. Common in songs, popular, dangerous, and then my ode, the bad one, you know, to the youth of my country, you know. It was, by God, in an iambic tetrameter, and I can't go around reminding people of it. So this poem can't be published. The book can't have the census permit so long as it's there. And my friend at the bureau, my good friend, Censor Goyne, can't spell recommend. Goyne takes the trouble to recommend improvements. All I have to do is add an extra foot to each line, just a word or two. He showed me how to do it. Really very simple, he said. They've banned what I've written. Now they rewrite what I write. The eyes in the white face were round, yellowish, glaring. Itali thought of the half-grown hawks he had tamed, their rage and resistance that only exhaustion could control. And even in defeat, they would cry out in their shrill, terrible voices, defeated, not tamed. You've endured 6 years of this, Haleska said. How do you have the courage to go through it all again? I don't. When I get this book in press, I'm done, going home. I can't fight to try to get it distributed. It won't be. I will stay just long enough to be sure the text isn't changed, to keep Goyne's improvements out of it. I don't know why I bother even with that. What difference will it make? A great deal, Mr. Estenska, Itali said, stammering. Because the book will be printed by the clandestine press. I've never seen your books but in the clandestine editions. Victory without profit, the poet said dryly. No man, not even a genius, can win this kind of battle unsupported. If there were a group, a real group, with a publication, a journal, ready to come out against the Bureau of Censorship every day for every word, a steady united pressure, and if the estates are convened, censorship will be an issue. I see it's true. You've been here only 2 hours, Estenska said, turning back to the bookcase. He scanned it as if seeking a title while he spoke. A group. Literary men are afraid of jail as a rule. As for getting help from the politicians, I suppose you're joking. Itali was paralyzed. Haleska said, as easily as ever, Why so, Amadei? If the estates meet, there'll be some new men in town. You're in an optimistic fit tonight? I'm an optimistic man. I merely keep it to myself, so that I won't get laughed at. As to the youth of my country got laughed at, for example. And rightly. It's the stupidest thing I ever wrote. I suppose Mr. Sode disagrees. Perhaps it was invitation, but Itali took it as reproof, understanding only that his enthusiasm had been gall to Estenska. "How can I argue with you?" he said, almost inaudibly. Haleska frowned. "You wrote it? Let us read it, Amadei. Allow us our little privileges. They don't encroach on yours. I believe we need a change of music. Louisa's in a vile mood tonight. She always plays well in a vile mood. Shall we go demand some Mozart?" Though enmeshed in self-castigation, Itali was vaguely aware that Haleska had come to his defense, and in an equally vague persuasion of obligation, followed the two back into the salon, though what he wanted was to get away from Estenska before he antagonized his hero any further. Louisa Parodeska agreed to play. He stood with the group around the piano. It was past midnight. He was worn out. The radiant music passed him by as so much noise. Haleska and Baron Parodeska talked beside him. He did not listen, and he would not open his mouth again, not if he were damned for it. "Why am I here?" he thought. "What am I doing here? Why did I leave home?" When she had played what was asked of her, Louisa Parodeska sat on at the piano, listening to the others talk. Every now and then, she glanced up at the tall, stiff, speechless young man. There he stood, with his chin stuck into his collar, the epitome of boorish, provincial, male complacency. Should have liked to kick him. "Who is that fellow, Baronina?" "Enrique found it on the coach. I don't plan to keep it around long." Estenska smiled disagreeably. "He hardly seemed to partake of the ton," he said. He was on the attack again. Louisa, who loved battles, rose to the challenge and performed a rapid outflanking maneuver. She smiled straight at him and said, "You're not really going off east, are you, Amadei?" "I haven't decided." "What is there to decide? Is there anything in the Polana besides the east wind and sheep? Will the sheep listen to you? I know we are sheep to you, but we are attentive sheep, adoring sheep, your own woolly flock." "Sheep's clothing." "That's you, the wolf, the Polana wolf. Don't run away, Amadei, not now." "I'm not running away. I'm going home." "Home?" She played a light, derisive arpeggio. "We have a home, too, you know, up in the Sovena. I know all about rain and wind and mud and sheep and the neighbors' visits. They tell you hunting stories, how they shot the wolf, how they bagged three poets in the marsh last winter. I'll come back for your wedding."
"Oh, indeed.
My wedding with whom?" "George, of course." "How silly you are. I can't marry an old shoe."
"If the shoe fits."
"Always twist the knife a little before you remove it. No, I think I shall marry a total stranger, someone found on a coach."
"Why?"
"Because there would be a few weeks before he knew how to hurt me very much, before he learned where the nerves are. Unless he was a poet, of course. But you mustn't leave Krasnoy, Amadei. What shall I do without you? Without my daily anti-opium?"
"I wish I had fallen in love with you, Louisa."
"Yes, but you didn't." She looked up into the man's unhappy face and smiled again. When he got to bed at 2:30, Itali could not sleep. The Mozart sonata, to which he had not listened, rang note for note in his head. The red curtain bed swayed like a coach at the trot. His ears were full of voices and his eyes of faces. He lay and twitched and turned. The deep, soft bell told the quarters and the hours. 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, over the dark roofs, the dark streets, the endless houses where 200,000 people slept, and he among them, awake, a prisoner.